It's At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. Arden Zwelling with Ben Nicholson-Smith. Today is Thursday, April the 3rd, 2025. Our producer is Christian Ryan. Thanks so much for listening. Ben, you love baseball. Baseball is back on your screen of choice every single day. You must be one happy customer.
Yeah, you know what? It actually is nice having games that count back and some games at different times, like the late games, the Dodgers games late. That's been nice. The Jays have actually been very entertaining so far. It's great to have baseball back. It's great to, you know, start to decipher meaning out of all this stuff. Of course, some surprise storylines like the torpedo bats, of course. And, you know, it's nice to have a little more juice than we had at the end of spring training.
Torpedo bats are like this year's, the uniforms are weird. Remember that? Like,
yep.
The jerseys are strange. That's basically this year's version of that. You mentioned it. The Blue Jays are 5-2 through their first seven. They go 5-2 on their season opening homestand over a 4-game set against the Orioles and a 3-game set against the Nationals. You mentioned that you've been sitting there deciphering meaning. What kind of meaning do you think can be deciphered by an objectively good run of play, but still not even 5% of the way into the regular season?
Yeah, you know, not a whole lot has changed about the way that I might view the individual players on this team. You know, Max Scherzer being hurt, which I'm sure we'll get to, but that's, you know, not a shock. He's 40 years old. We knew he was dealing with some stuff in spring training. Some players are off to good starts, some players are not. That's to be expected. The one thing that I would actually take away from this week is just the 5-2 record. I mean, that is something that's kind of indelibly there. And whatever happens player to player moving forward, the Blue Jays are 3 games above 500. And that's probably a little better than anyone would have guessed. And they needed this. They needed a hot start. They couldn't afford, just given how tough the rest of their schedule is throughout the month of April, the National Series was the one weak spot. So I thought they really had to win a couple of those games at minimum. To sweep, I think, is pretty huge because it's going to be really tough from here on for them. They might kind of hover around 500 for the next couple, you know, few weeks. And I think that'll be fine if they did, just given the schedule. But to bank a few wins, that's almost my biggest takeaway out of all of this.
Playoff odds opened at 40.7% on opening day, and they are all the way up to 47.4, baby.
That's pretty good, though. That's a big difference.
Close to a coin flip the rest of the way. Yeah, like it's, you can't draw any sweeping conclusions. You can't really take anything as predictive. You know, you can just say that over these 7 games, the Blue Jays have won 5 of them, and that's a really good result for a season opening homestand. I don't think that Andrés Giménez's hot bat to this point really tells you anything about just what he's going to look like at the end of the season, just as George Springer's hot streak doesn't tell you anything, just as Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s relatively cool start and Anthony Santander's much cooler start doesn't really tell us anything about where these guys are going to end up come the end of September. Like, these are just things that have happened. To me, they are in no way predictive and shouldn't really be used to forward cast any kind of analysis with these players.
Okay, so I agree with most of that. You know, when you're talking about Santander, of course, he's going to hit. He's going to have some dingers. We all expect that. That's the reasonable thing to expect. Springer, he's going to cool down. He's not going to stay at this kind of level all season. The one guy I wonder about a little bit is Giménez there. When you look at the changes to his setup, getting back to the leg kick, getting away from the toe tap, opening the stance up a little bit more as he's worked with David Popkins, and then having these results, I was pretty skeptical of Giménez entering the season, and I still think that, you know, this is not your prototypical cleanup hitter, of course. He's, you know, in a good season, he might hit 15 homers for the Jays. I don't see him as like this dominant power bat, but I would say I have nudged my expectations ahead a little for Giménez.
With Santander, just follow up on that quickly. This is a notorious slow starter. Like, for his career, He has a 659 OPS in the months of March and April, by far his lowest OPS of any month. If you look at the splits over his entire career, for May in his career, his OPS is 825. So that is, you know, nearly a 200-point increase in OPS month over month. So for one reason or another, Anthony Santander just not a guy who loves playing ball in April, or it just takes some time to get going. So yeah, no need to worry about him there. With Jimenez, I mean, the adjustments are interesting. Like he very clearly has made some tweaks at the plate, and you know, some of the new StatCast stuff that we have access to on Baseball Savant now can show you like really clearly that you know, he is like further back in the box and his stance is a bit narrower and he is standing a bit more open to the pitcher than he has in the past. And like you said, you know, David Popkins has talked about some of the tweaks and adjustments they've made, and you can obviously, you don't need a Savant graph to see the leg kick that he's now using every day. I just like, I can go back to dozens upon dozens of stories, and I'm sure you can as well, that I've written about, oh, this guy introduced a toe tap and got hot for 3 weeks. Oh, this guy introduced a leg kick and, you know, hit four homers in a week. And it was, oh, he's fixed, he's solved, they figured it out. And then all of a sudden the league figures out what you're doing and they adjust to you and they start pitching you differently. It is a game of adjustments. You could just look at like the career of Davis Schneider is such a good case study, you know, of somebody who makes a ton of adjustments, somebody who tinkers a lot, and it can seem like he's found something for a week or two, and then all of a sudden he starts getting pitched differently and he has to adjust again. So take nothing away from Jimenez. Like, he's been full value over this first week, but like, I, you know, the much greater sample that we have of him over the last couple years has been not this, and I'm sure that he was making a lot of adjustments over those couple of years as well, trying to find something that worked. So I'm just going to need to see it for longer.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair approach. For me, it's not a total transformation. And there's a great piece by this by David Singh. You can check it out at sportsnet.ca, getting into some of these details here. But for me, going into the season, I probably thought he was going to be like a 90 OPS plus, a below average hitter. And at this point, I'm nudging that up a little bit closer to league average. It's not a total transformation. I don't think he's going to be the Blue Jays' best hitter all year, of course, but I'm intrigued by what we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me is that while the hard hit rate has clearly gone up and he's clearly hitting the ball you know, with much higher exit velos more consistently than he has in the past, you haven't seen an increase in the swing and miss at the same time. Like, he's actually whiffing at the lowest rate of his career. That's what's interesting to me, is that he's actually gotten to this power without sacrificing some contact, without introducing some swing and miss. I'm going to be interested to see if those things can remain consistent going forward, because to me, you know, sometimes you're just going to hit the ball right at guys, and sometimes it's going to go over the wall and not. And there's going to be balls that you hit at Yankee Stadium that go into the seats that at Kauffman are like, don't even make it to the warning track. So strip all that stuff out and you take that away. If you are making consistent contact, making a high quality of contact, if you are making good swing decisions and selecting good pitches to go after, and if you are not running up a ton of swing and miss, like, those are things that I think can help sustain you offensively. And so far it has been interesting to see that Jimenez has hit the ball harder while whiffing less. Like, those things are encouraging.
And Springer, another high fly ball, and it's deep, and it is gone.
Yeah, it's a good combo. And, you know, I agree with you that strikeout rate, seeing how a hitter controls the zone, you want to see that trending in a positive direction. And it's a good indicator, especially early when the samples are so small. But when I look at George Springer and I see that he's striking out more, I actually kind of counterintuitively think that that's a good thing for him and for the Blue Jays, because he's gotten away from his power in recent years, at least compared to where he was with the Astros and early in his Blue Jays career. So I think if he exchanges some singles for some strikeouts, but also a few more home runs or a few more extra base hits, I think that can be a good thing. So I actually, when I look at Springer's production and the way he's getting to it by swinging, you know, making some really good contact, maybe swinging and missing a little bit more, I don't mind that as a combination for the Jays.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's also pulling the ball a lot more, which I think is a big one for him. Like, he's clearly just trying to yank fastballs to his left side. And you can see, like, in his setup at the plate and in his mechanics that there is an effort being made to get his front foot down earlier and to just be a bit more open in his stance. And I think that has something to do with him trying to get on fastballs early and him maybe trying to compensate for a lack of bat speed or just a changing profile as a hitter, where he's no longer going to be this like all around pure hitter guy who can cover a bunch of different areas of the zone and read and react to a bunch of different pitches and go the opposite way and shoot balls into the gaps. Like, in his mid 30s, he might just not be that guy anymore. He might need to do some of that sort of old guy hitter stuff that we've seen from like a Brandon Belt or a Justin Turner at Rogers Center over the last couple of years, where maybe you cheat to a couple of fastballs, maybe you guess a little bit, maybe you try to set up the pitcher a little bit and try to make them think that you're looking for one thing when you're actually looking for another, and try to sort of goad them into throwing you the pitch that you want to see. Some of that same Savant data will tell us that he is a bit further back in the box, and he is a bit wider in the box, a bit more open in his stance. So I think those are things that'll just give him a better shot at pulling some more of those fastballs he's going to get attacked with naturally in the air to his left side. And if he can keep doing that, he's clearly still got like the exit velo and the power to hit a bunch of homers. And if he has that type of approach, I wouldn't be surprised to see him go over 20, honestly, this year. I don't think he's going to any longer be a guy who's going to run like a 270, 280 batting average. Like you said, I think that the strikeout rate is likely to stay higher than it's been in the past. But if he can continue to walk at the rate that he has in his career and then mix in those homers and work sort of pesky discerning plate appearances, at least see a bunch of pitches per plate appearance, he could be that like 105 to 110 weighted runs created plus guy that is honestly a pretty good outcome for the Blue Jays at this stage in his career.
Yeah, and this is where I like the Blue Jays offense as a whole. I mean, there's some vulnerability there, of course, as you see with most teams. You know, Davis Schneider still looking for that first hit. He has not looked good so far, and I think that that's kind of a question here in the next 4 months that the Blue Jays have to answer. If they're going to be buyers, is he the right-handed bench bat, or do you have to go out and find a right-handed bench bat? So you're not going to make that decision after 10 plate appearances, of course. And to your point earlier, he can be a streaky hitter. But I actually do like the overall offense here, where you're seeing Alan Rodon looks like he belongs. He's making consistent contact. He's making some hard contact at times and giving the Blue Jays some good, even productive outs like sacrifice flies and just doing what's expected of him and what's needed of him as a major league player. So to see him doing that, to see Will Wagner also looking comfortable, looking good at the plate in the early going, these are pretty big developments that have the chance to lengthen the Blue Jays lineup and make up for times like this where Vlad Jr. just hasn't been hitting. So they have enough other depth in the lineup that they get by. They go 5-2 without their best player. And then when Vlad Jr. goes off, you have a potential for him to make up for the inevitable slumps that will come from other players.
Yeah, I think Will Wagner's actually been really encouraging early in the year with just kind of his poise and his metal in the box, the type of plate appearance that he works. He can clearly get his bat to a lot of pitches. He can clearly use the whole field. You'd like to see him work a walk at some point. It would be nice if that showed up. Like, this is a guy who had double-digit walk rates in the minors, and that's something that's obviously going to tail off in the majors against, you know, tougher pitching that locates better than minor leaguers do. But you're going to want to see more than zero walks a week out of Will Wagner if he's going to sustain at this level, because the batting average and balls in play is not always going to be 500 as it is now. But I think that he's, you know, just the approach and the plate appearances that he's had when he's in the box have been really encouraging for him. And also on defense, like, he's made the plays and he's showed off the arm strength, and he's given a bit of proof of concept to what we've been hearing from Blue Jays coaches for a while, that this is a guy who was playing on one leg last year And, you know, everyone would say, like, look, if once he gets his knee sorted out and once he's no longer playing in pain all the time, he's going to show a lot better defensively. And we've seen that so far this season. Like, he is playable. He is capable at third base, which just opens up the various roster constructions for John Schneider on a nightly basis.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We've seen Schneider using that flexibility, mixing different guys in, even getting contributions. And this is where, like, you look at the overall offense, it's been great. It's been really, really good so far. And part of the reason for that is you have Tyler Heineman going off with a home run. You have Miles Straw contributing with a couple doubles. Like, those guys are really defense-first players. If they have a few games like this in the course of the year, realistically, that's kind of like the, well, maybe for Straw, there's a bit of a higher ceiling. For Heineman, like, honestly, if he does this five times, you're thrilled to be able to have, you know, game-changing hits like that. So just to get that balance and have that depth, it's hugely impactful for this team. And the longer they can keep this up, they'll stay relevant if they can keep hitting like this.
Heineman gets into one, pulls it to left, and it's gone. His first action of the season here today, and he has extended the lead to two.
Yeah, Heineman's here to take care of things behind the plate and to be very good at receiving and game calling and controlling the running game and all those things. Anything that he provides offensively is bonus.
Yeah.
So look, as often as he wants to drop a bunt down the third base line or to reach first when he sees the defense isn't expecting it, go for it, man. Do that. You know, as often as he can, like, just foul off a bunch of pitches and get deep into a plate appearance, especially if it's like the type of inning where, say, the first two hitters make outs on three or four pitches, if he can just kind of like go up and battle and run up a pitch count, that's great. Like, that's gravy. Anytime that, you know, he comes up behind a leadoff double and he can just hit a ground ball to the right side, perfect. Take whatever he's going to give you offensively, but as long as he's sort of handling things well behind the plate, as I think he did with Easton Lucas the other day, that's gravy. It's interesting with the lineups and the roster construction right now. Like, essentially, like, you've got your top four of Bichette, Vlad, Santander, and Jimenez. Like, those are just everyday, every inning players. And then you've got Alejandro Kirk, who's looks like he's going to start four out of six, with Tyler Heineman starting the other two. So Kirk's your starting catcher. George Springer, I mean, he starts what, six of the first seven? So, I mean, that's pretty realistic. Five of six, six of seven going forward. He's going to be in there most times. Will Wagner as well, five of six, six of seven. Like, those are your kind of quote unquote regulars. And then you are seeing, you know, Lucas, Roden, Straw, Clement, Davis Schneider, all kind of being leveraged differently depending on matchups and depending on defensive alignments and depending on whether you got a ground ball pitcher on the mound or a fly ball pitcher on the mound and depending on who you want off the bench to pinch hit for late. Like, there was a day recently where John Schneider had like three lefties at the bottom of his order, and he kind of set up the opposition to bring in a lefty, and all of a sudden it was here comes Clement and here comes Schneider off the bench, and those two guys both reached base, and Blue Jays had a nice inning late in the game. So I think that there's just like a lot more flexibility down the roster this year, particularly without like a belt or a turner who are kind of one-dimensional and can only be used a certain way. It looks like there's a lot more fluidity and a lot more dynamic lineups that can be used this year. That's been interesting to see so far.
Yeah, I like this overall composition. Like I said, I think for me, the main question, arguably, I guess it's Roden and Wagner and how they can contribute in their first full seasons. Those are still pretty big variables. Then beyond that, like, one of the main questions is on the bench with Schneider. Can he be a reliable bench bat, as, you know, obviously starting against some lefties as well? Can he be that guy who really crushes left-handed pitching? We'll see. But there are a lot of really solid hitters, some of whom are off to really encouraging starts. And then you still have a little bit of depth at AAA, you know, whether it's Aníbal Martínez, Class A, Lo Perfido, guys that we talked about in the course of the spring on ATL, and kind of reinforcing that if they do need to go down to that level to get a little bit of production, they actually do have a couple options there. Riley Tirada, you know, you've got some dudes that could step in and potentially contribute. So I think they're in a good spot offensively, and certainly the numbers bear that out early, where collectively they're hitting 288 and an OPS approaching 800.
Now, I will say the slugging percentage leaves something to be desired so far this season. The Blue Jays have hit a ton of singles, and that's great. Like, they've won 5 of 7, and you know, all 3 wins against the Nationals were well earned. And you know, I think that against the Orioles, the Blue Jays didn't play particularly well and were not the best team in that series, but they got away with a split. You take that and you don't look back. So credit to them for that. But eventually the Blue Jays are going to need to find some more thump. And we are 7 games into the season, and the only Blue Jays who have hit home runs are Andrés Giménez, George Springer, and Tyler Heineman. There are 5 home runs through 7 games, and that is just not going to cut it long term. Like, Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Anthony Santander, Alejandro Kirk, none of them have gone deep yet. You know, Will Wagner and Alan Rodon aren't going to be massive power guys, but the Blue Jays could use like 10 apiece from those guys if they're on the roster all season. We'll see if, you know, when Dalton Varsho comes back, whether that means Alan Rodon goes back to AAA, or whether that means Nathan Lucas gets optioned and Rodon sticks around. Maybe Davis Schneider gets optioned, although that would make things a bit tough defensively. But there's another guy who the Blue Jays could use some pop from in Schneider, if he's going to be on this roster. And like you said, if he's going to be a right-handed bench bat who's coming in to face lefties late in games, like, he's going to have to clip one every once in a while. And so I think that if you, the canary in the coal mine a little bit of the Blue Jays offense, which, as we've said, like, we just spent, you know, 15 minutes giving them credit, they've done a good job. They've strung together hits. They've had good plate appearances. They've, you know, done the little things. Great. That's cool. But the Blue Jays got to start hitting for some power soon, or things are going to turn in a hurry, I think, when it comes to the outcomes of these games.
Yeah, there is a little bit of irony to some of this, where, you know, they bring in David Popkins, and Don Mattingly, of course, was the hitting coordinator before overseeing everything. And his approach was a little bit more, hey, let's make some contact. Let's try to, you know, make sure that we're not necessarily striking out. And that was the way that he might have viewed things. Bring in Popkins, he's like, let's do damage. Let's absolutely slug this baseball. Let's take some big swings. And the Blue Jays have been really, really good under Popkins, but it's actually been more of a Don Mattingly type batting line, where you see the high average, you see the good OBP, and not necessarily a ton of slug. And I'm not trying to be super reductive in describing this, because of course Don Mattingly likes dingers, and of course David Popkins likes singles, but you look at this shift, and I guess it just reinforces its small samples, right? Because it's, you know, this early in the season, the Jays will get to some of that damage. Santander, Bo, Vlad, that has to happen. The safe assumption is that it will happen. When it does, the Blue Jays will get a bit more balance to this offensive approach.
Yeah, and we've seen Bichette barrel some balls. We've obviously seen Vlad barrel some balls. That's all he does. He has a 70% hard hit rate this year. Springer's barreling everything right now. Like, eventually, like, some of, if you continue that process, you continue hitting the ball that hard, the ball is going to leave the yard at some point. It's a very strong correlation between barrel rate, hard hit rate, and power outcomes. But it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, the contact approach. I mean, something I hear a lot from David Popkins, Lou Iannotti, you know, some Blue Jays hitters as well have been working with them, is just actually contact point and kind of where they're impacting the ball. And like, George Springer is a good example of a guy who last year had like one of the lowest contact points in baseball in terms of like not being out front. So in terms of essentially making contact behind the front of the plate, it's going to be a lot harder to hit for power if you're making contact behind the front of the plate that often, because then you're going the opposite way a lot. And obviously it's harder to hit the ball over the fence when you're going the opposite way, unless your name is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and you can just hit the ball out anywhere. And this season so far, Springer again is like a good example of someone who is now, thanks to some of the changes that he's made in his stance and in his swing, is now making contact out front more consistently. Andrés Giménez as well, making contact out front more consistently. So clearly, like, these hitting coaches are trying to make some adjustments with these hitters to generate more power and to hit more homers and to pull more balls in the air. I think you just haven't seen it show up in the results just yet through a week. I'm interested to see if you know, if hitters can stick to that process and trust that process and that approach and trust that those results will come and not get antsy to make any adjustments or fall back into old habits. I am interested just to see how it plays out as the results continue to maybe not go their way, because I think eventually the results will, if they keep making contact in the fashion that they have been. But you know, it's always, it's harder to trust that process when you're the one in the box every night and you're going up there and saying, oh man, it's been 10 games, I don't have a homer. It's been 11 games, I don't have a homer. I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out.
Right. Some patience, or do they just place a torpedo bat order and just, you know, throw caution to the wind? Do you not like this storyline?
I mean, I'm just bored of it.
You're bored of it already?
Yeah, I just think it's overblown. Like, it's for certain guys who make certain types of contact. Like, if you're someone who tends to impact the ball a lot towards the label, it makes a lot of sense. You know, like Anthony Volpe is like a great example of someone who makes a lot of sense for. But like, I don't think that if you gave this bat to Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who has a great feel for the barrel and for the sweet spot, that all of a sudden he would hit like 70 home runs.
No,
you know, I don't think Shohei Ohtani's going to hit 80 because you give him this thing, right? So it's for guys who just have less than ideal point of contact naturally. It's a way to kind of help them get a bit more. But I don't think it's this, the way that it's portrayed as, oh, the Yankees found this great secret and made this great advancement in technology or whatever. It's not the case. It's just a few guys on the Yankees are using it, and the Yankees hit a bunch of home runs off of pitches that were like middle. So I just think that it's been the way that it's been portrayed is a bit misleading.
Well, it's certainly not a cheat code, and it's you still have to hit the ball, obviously. That's incredibly hard to do no matter what kind of bat you're using. I think I'm a little more intrigued by it than maybe you are, because I think that, you know, when you think about all the hitters in baseball, hundreds and hundreds of hitters, and they're all essentially using the same shaped bat, like when you actually think about that, it's a little wild that there isn't a little bit more differentiation as far as the shape of the bat. Just, you know, to use the golf club analogy, you're making a different shot on a golf course, you're going to reach for a different club depending on the moment. And I just think that having a little bit more flexibility where maybe some days or against some pitchers or for some stretches of the season, you want to have that bat in your arsenal and to go to, I think it kind of makes sense. And it's actually sort of, it's kind of shocking to me that there hasn't been more innovation in this sphere before, and that there hasn't been more kind of creativity when it comes to the kinds of bats used, that it was simply one size fits all for all of baseball history for every single hitter.
Well, the torpedo bat's been around for a while though. And like
since last year, I mean, not that long.
But it's, the guys are aware of it. It's been throughout the league. Like David Schneider was using one before this was ever a story. You know, if the White Sox had hit like five homers in a day on the weekend and a couple of them were using it, I don't think it would have been as big of a story as it was when it was the Yankees who were doing it.
I agree. And I think that the fact that it was Volpe would be different than if it was like Jacob Amaya going yard a couple times. But my impression is from talking to players about this is that this has really surfaced as something that people are aware of in the last week. And that, of course, players on the Yankees were aware of this last year, but it definitely wasn't a talking point. You know, you and I were covering Yankees playoff games. I wasn't aware of this. I don't think that the media was aware of this. And I don't think a lot of players were aware of this. So I think the awareness has only sunk in the last 4 or 5 days.
I just, every player I talk to when it comes to a bat, it's like it's a feel thing. It's not, oh, if I have a, this is a 32 versus the 33, or a, what, this is a torpedo versus a whatever. It's how does it feel in your hand, and how does it feel when you're swinging it? Like, that's the biggest thing, I think, for players. I do think if you're somebody who makes contact towards the label, like, this does increase your margin for error a little bit. And I think that could be useful for hitters like that. Just kind of, it almost like moves the sweet spot on the bat a little bit for them and changes the weight distribution, and I think will allow them to have some higher exit velos if that's just the type of contact they make naturally. But you know, if you gave this to Barry Bonds, I don't think he was going to hit 100 homers.
No.
Right? Like,
no.
So
no,
I just think
not.
it's something for certain players who like the feel and who make a certain kind of contact. So that's why, to me, like, it's not as sexy of a story, really, because I think a lot of those players who could benefit from it discovered that last year and have been using it since last year. I think they were probably using it in the playoffs last year. We just didn't. It just wasn't a story because it isn't that big of a story.
I don't think that many players were using it last year, first of all. And we certainly haven't seen footage of it. And I think to go from one type of bat to two is a pretty big deal. Even if, totally agree, Barry Bonds, instead of hitting 73 home runs, if he had had this, maybe he would have hit 71, maybe he would have hit 74. I think Bonds and some of these elite players in this game are pretty much maxing out what they can do. So I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all by any stretch, but I think that for some players, this could be really valuable. And to have that choice, I think, is a pretty noteworthy change.
Sure. We shall see. Let's step away. But when we come back, we've got to do the decision of the week, and we probably got to talk some pitching because this was all hitting, and the Blue Jays have pitchers who throw a lot of pitches as well. So all that and more when we continue on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producer is Christian Ryan. It's time now for Decision of the Week, presented by MLB The Show 25. How will your journey evolve? Ben, the Blue Jays are without Max Scherzer, only 3 innings in to his season. That is unfortunate for a number of reasons. Chief among them, we don't get to watch Max Scherzer every 5 days. But of more concern for the Blue Jays is that it has left a hole in their rotation. And they are opening the season with 20 games in 21 days. So not much room for creativity as far as moving guys around and bullpen days and trying to sort of paper that over until Scherzer's ready to return. So far, we've seen Easton Lucas fill that hole rather capably on Wednesday. 5 scoreless innings against the Nationals, looked really solid. I thought looked like really composed and really poised on the mound. I liked his rhythm. I liked just the way that he went about things. Of course, that is the Nationals, who are not a great team and a very left-handed lineup, which made a lot of sense for Easton Lucas to face. And the Blue Jays have not committed to Easton Lucas remaining in that role going forward. John Schneider saying that, you know, he's going to preserve the flexibility and the right to do some different things at that spot. So how do you think the Blue Jays should handle their 5th starter spot as they go forward through the rest of this month without Max Scherzer?
Yeah, I think it's a make no promises type of situation. Definitely impressed by Easton Lucas and the way that he was able to pitch, generating 11 swings and misses, really locating his fastball well, mixing in the off speed, doing everything that you could possibly hope for from him in his first major league start.
And he struck him out. Another fastball. Easton Lucas Buck has 11 swings and misses in today's game.
At the same time, I mean, I don't think that you just hand him the spot. It sounds like the Blue Jays would consider pairing him with Yariel Rodriguez to potentially get through 6 innings with that combination. Of course, Yariel has looked pretty good at times in more of a high leverage setup role. So you could do that. You could do Eric Lauer, who you wrote about at Sportsnet.ca this week, and look at him in one of those roles. I don't think there's any way around needing a starting pitcher. So I think that I would be inclined to roll with Easton Lucas, but keep him on a short leash. I'm not assuming that what we saw against the Nationals will translate against the Red Sox or translate against the Orioles, because those offenses are just a lot better and a lot deeper than the ones that we saw with the Washington Nationals.
Yeah, I think the best thing that Easton Lucas did against the Nationals was he stayed off the heart of the plate. Like, everything was to the edges or elevated or down. And he really didn't give them like a lot of quality pitches to hit. Like, there wasn't much middle in there. He didn't make a lot of mistakes. But at the same time, he didn't really land his secondary stuff for strikes very often. I think that, you know, the Nationals did him some favors, and that a better lineup is probably going to recognize that, hey, like, this guy's not landing the changeup or the slider for a strike ever, so why don't we just eliminate those pitches and sit on the fastball, which is 93. You know, we saw a couple 94s in there from Lucas, but still, like, this is a below league average velo fastball that doesn't have like a ton of super interesting like characteristics when it comes to shape. So I think that like a good lineup, now that, you know, Lucas has put this on video, will likely have a better approach against him, and it's going to be incumbent on him to like prove, hey, no, I can land a changeup. Hey, I can land a slider. Like, hey, it's not just going to be fastballs. Like, you're going to have to respect some other pitches from me. So that's something I'll be interested to look at his next time out. I think that if you're the Blue Jays, you keep playing this matchup based, which I think is what they did with having Lucas start against the Nationals instead of starting in New York against the Mets, and kind of pushing Gausman to that series, because just in terms of overall quality of competition and the handedness of the competition, like, the Nationals are just a very good matchup for Lucas to face. So depending on who the matchup is next time and what their roster is looking like, maybe Ariel Rodriguez is actually the better matchup there. Maybe Lucas is a good matchup again. You know, like you said, like, maybe a Jake Bloss is you know, the better option against that particular lineup, because you know, they don't do well with elevated high spin fastballs. You know, maybe Eric Lauer is the better option there, because as a lefty with some more pitches that he can land consistently, he can kind of keep them off balance. Like, I think, you know, maybe a bullpen day is best, because you want to attack the top of the lineup with an opener from the left or right side, and then go to like a bulk Lucas or Yariel outing. I think that, like, if you're the Blue Jays, you really do just kind of match up with what you're going to be facing and try to put yourself in the best possible position to win, because you don't really have an option that you're like, yep, every 5 days, this is the guy. He's going to get us through five innings, allowing only two or three runs.
Yeah. And this connects to, you know, something that we've talked about at length this spring and this season, is that the Jays don't have that clear depth behind their starting five. And the top four guys in this rotation are off to pretty stellar starts, with the exception of Barrios on opening day. You're kind of getting what you hope for from that group. But then Scherzer goes down, not a shock, 40 years old. You need to have some depth behind that. And this is where organizationally it's a big hole for this team. And they're going to have to find ways to overcome that, either by developing some of these guys, or by finding guys like an Easton Lucas who are on waivers last summer, and you just get the most out of them, like you said, in an individual matchup. So next week against the Red Sox at Fenway Park, that's a lineup that starts with a lot of lefties. You got Duran, Devers, Casas. That's a lineup to me that you let Easton Lucas roll through 1.5 times. If he's really going, maybe you let him roll through it, you know, to the top of that order a third time. But I would be looking at Yariel Rodriguez for the bottom of that Red Sox order. You got some right-handed bats there, typically speaking, your Christian Campbells and your Connor Wongs and your Rafaelis. At that point, maybe it's time to bring in Yariel. Maybe it's the fourth inning, but you just go to him, and it's not ideal. It will put a tax on this pitching staff, because, you know, five innings is probably the ceiling of the volume that you're going to get from an Easton Lucas, or certainly from a Yariel, but that's where they're at. So it's going to be maybe the biggest challenge that they face here in the first month of the season.
Yeah, and this is going to be an ongoing thing, because Max Scherzer, the treatment he's received for his thumb is a cortisone shot. So what the Blue Jays are doing there is they're treating the symptom. Like, they aren't treating the cause of the issue. So that's going to wear off at some point. And, like, I think it makes sense to do it right now rather than having surgery, or rather than, like, having 3 months of rest and seeing how it is there then. Just considering where Max that is in his career and what the Blue Jays need from him this season, I think it makes sense to get him to a point where he feels good gripping the ball and throwing the ball, and just kind of seeing how long he can do that for before this crops up again, which seems almost inevitable at this point. Because, you know, he's going to be throwing in New York, it sounds like, and then he's going to have to ramp back up, and then he's going to have a little minor league rehab assignment. So you're not going to see him until May, but this more conservative treatment option gets him back sooner than surgery or rest or something that could put him out until July. And man, the Blue Jays might just be out of it by July. So this is something like, it might be Easton Lucas this week and Yariel Rodriguez next. It might be Eric Lauer for a stretch in early June, because Max has to be backed off once again. And you know, Lauer is a guy who has a track record as a back end starter, somebody who, you know, for his career is like a perfect 100 ERA plus, so a totally league average starter, and somebody who has averaged 5 innings per start over the course of his career over a really substantial sample, like over 500 innings. So maybe he's an option at some point, but you know, this isn't just going to be a first few weeks of April thing. Like, this is going to be a story for the rest of the year.
Well, realistically, with Scherzer, he was only built up to 45 pitches. And because of the way that the thumb flared up, that meant that they pulled him before he could build up that stamina and that workload. Now he goes into a brief shutdown period, potentially throwing as soon as Friday. But then once he throws off flat ground, we all know the progression, right? It's off a mound, it's facing hitters. Then for Scherzer, it probably means a minor league rehab start or two, likely with extra days of rest baked in, because the last thing you want to do is rush this guy back and have him starting, you know, the moment that he's available. You want to make sure that the inflammation's clearing out should it come back. So you got to play it safe here. But at the same time, this has got to be interesting for the Blue Jays behind the scenes, because it's like, they paid him $15.5 million, not to be Mad Max on the bench, not to be like an alternate pitching coach. They paid him to pitch, and Scherzer wants to pitch. There's no question about that. So they're aligned from that standpoint. But, you know, you kind of have to get what you can out of him too. Like, this isn't Joey Votto, like, minor league deal situation. This guy earns $15.5 million. You want to get something out of him.
No, absolutely. It's and like you said, Max is absolutely chomping at the bit to pitch. Yes. As well. Like, he was dealing with this thumb thing in spring, and he was telling anyone who would listen, "Hey, my thumb hurts. Hey, I don't like what's happening right now. Like, hey, I'm in danger." And he's tried to gut his way through it. And even as he warmed up for that first outing of the year, told Pete Walker and John Schneider, like, "Hey, like, this might not be for long. I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna try to get as many outs as I can, but this doesn't feel great." And then I think the quote was, I came back into the dugout after the third inning and told John Schneider, "We are in imminent danger." So,
yep.
So I think Max Scherzer pushed this just about as far as he could to be on the mound in the regular season and to contribute. It's gonna be interesting to see what it's like when he comes back.
Yeah, and I will say, just from a media standpoint, it's great, the honesty and the knowledge that he has of his own symptoms, of his own body. I'm sure that John Schneider appreciates this too, and he's said as much. But, you know, Scherzer can so clearly explain what's going on. There is no BS here. He's like, "Yep, I pretty much am going to have to, you know, get this thumb to zero before I can go again. Probably not making my next start." Next day, he's on the IL. Like, he's not trying to create mystique. He's being very straight up with what's happening, even explaining exactly what's going on with the thumb and the joints. And so, from a media standpoint, it's nice to have that kind of clarity and someone who's able to share the info. But the Jays they have him here to pitch. They need him to pitch. The fans want him to pitch. He wants to pitch. So we'll see where that leads.
I think the other element of this decision as well, it's a bit of an ancillary one, but that's what's best for Yariel Rodriguez going forward. Like, what role is best for him? Is he best served by kind of bouncing back and forth between, we might need you for bulk innings today, and in a few days we might need you to come in and face heart of the order in the eighth, and we might need you to mop up a few days after that. Do you think the Blue Jays would be better served by giving him some consistency to what his role will be and what his routines should be? Or do you think that it's okay that he sort of remains in this limbo of, hey, you might start a game soon, but you might also throw a leverage inning or mop up?
I think it's not ideal. Clearly, you just want guys who slot into roles and excel in them and you don't even think about it. But realistically, this is where they're at. So of all the pitchers that they could ask to jump between these different roles, I think he's the logical candidate. So it's not great for his development. It's probably not great for his, you know, just planning out what his week might look like. But part of his skill set, part of what he's being paid for, is that versatility. And so, yeah, I think you just got to roll with it. And I don't know what his best role is. He looked great in relief the other day, setting up for Jimmy Garcia. Thought that was one of his better outings that we've seen from him. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying like Easton Lucas is the solution in the rotation either. So I see the push to keep Yariel stretched out to at least, you know, 40, 50 pitches in case you need him for 2-3 innings at a time.
So I do think he looked good in that outing. I thought that the stuff was really electric, you know, particularly when he's running that fastball up, you know, like truly as hard as he can throw it and not saving anything in the tank and kind of hanging on because he has to pitch multiple innings. But I don't necessarily think his command was maybe as good as it's been portrayed. Like he was missing by a lot with some of those fastballs, and he was also leaving some pitches in like really bad spots over the heart of the plate and getting away with it. Like I think of, you know, a couple to Luis Garcia. You know, it was like a first pitch fastball that was like just up and over that was taken for a strike, and then he hung a slider to him as well that got barreled at like 100 miles per hour but ended up being an out. Like I understand the Blue Jays wanting to give him some encouragement and wanting to say like, no, yeah, that was great, that was the best inning of your professional career, like keep doing that, because he is like such an enigma and it is such a mystery box of like what you're gonna get when he enters the game. And that's kind of what makes it hard to really commit to him in any particular role. But I think like the biggest thing the Blue Jays need to get out of him is just like more consistent strike throwing, more consistent conviction, more consistent aggressiveness with the strike zone from the jump in his outings, so that he's not falling behind, so that he's not going to walk for strikeouts, so he's not constantly pitching with runners on, so that these aren't 20-25 pitch innings and they're more so 10-15 pitch innings. Like the stuff is unquestionable, the velo is unquestionable, the slider is nasty, he can make the mole, he can really manipulate the ball in a lot of different ways, and he's clearly got some pretty special arm talent, but some of the pitchability just really has not been there throughout his Blue Jays tenure, and I still haven't really seen that from him with any kind of consistency, and I think that's the biggest missing ingredient for him going forward.
Right. Regardless of what role the Blue Jays ask him to fill, it's not as though he's a sure thing for any of them. It's not a lock that he could be a dominant setup reliever. It's just not. Now, it's within his grasp. He certainly has the stuff to help the staff one way or the other. But as long as we're talking about late inning relief, I do want to mention just how good the combination of Jeff Hoffman and Jimmy Garcia has looked. And Blue Jays fans deserve this, honestly, after the absolutely putrid performance season long from that bullpen. You know, the nerves that would start to set in anytime there was a lead and you started to see that bullpen try to cover the last 4, 5, 6 outs of a game and often fail because it was, again, a historically bad, one of the worst bullpens in Major League Baseball last year. Yeah, Hoffman's looked incredible. He is just attacking hitters. Great split, great slider, great fastball. You know, a couple fastballs, really. He looks amazing. Jimmy Garcia up to 98 miles an hour. He's looking like, you know, the refreshed, healthy, fully charged Jimmy Garcia. And that's a great combination. You know, you toss in Brennan Little. I think those three, it's a really, really, really good top end talent for this bullpen.
I agree. I do think that the usage has to come down a little bit going forward.
No,
otherwise, you're not going to quite see those refreshed, healthy arms and that velocity and that bite anymore. A lot of relievers look great in the first week of the season, but Jimmy Garcia, Chad Green, and Jeff Hoffman, and Brendan Little all appear in 4 of the Blue Jays' first 7 games. So over the course of the season, that's like 92, 93 appearances. You're going to have to scale that down a little bit. Some of this workload's going to have to be shared. Blue Jays starters are going to have to get deeper into outings. Obviously, everyone's feeling good and fresh now and ready to go. So great. Like, use these guys while you have a bit of uncertainty in the rotation and while, you know, pitchers aren't quite built all the way up yet, if your name isn't Chris Bassett. But I do think that some of those impressive performances that you're referring to could go away in a hurry if these arms continue to be used the way they have been so far.
Without a doubt, they would. And this is where it comes back to home runs. Hit some dingers, win some games by six, and let, you know, Richard Lovelady was DFA'd, and rightfully so. Let Mason Fluharty get the last six outs of a game. Let Jacob Barnes get the last nine outs of a game when you're winning by eight or when you're down by eight. I mean, those games are going to happen either way. So there will be opportunity for the likes of Hoffman and Garcia to rest. You got to mix that in. I'm not loving what I'm seeing from Chad Green so far. You know, we'll see on that one. I liked the Hoffman deal from the jump, and I think that it continues to look great. And honestly, the Jimmy Garcia deal, that could be low-key like a bargain for the Blue Jays, especially if they're in the playoffs or in the playoff hunt. These are the kind of guys that are going to be getting such huge outs for the Jays. So it's already started. They're looking very good.
Yeah, the last Jimmy Garcia deal was a bargain for the Blue Jays. But I think that a really good point you just made there is the Blue Jays need to start increasing their margin of victory. Otherwise, they're constantly going to be in leverage and they're constantly going to be calling on their best relievers. And when their best relievers aren't available, they're going to be elevating other relievers into leverage, such as Jacob Barnes. And you mentioned Richard Lovelady and whoever else finds their way into this bullpen. We saw Mason Fluharty's MLB debut come in leverage. That's
super
not
high leverage. Yeah. Right? He was trying to preserve a one run lead, I think, at the time. And Jose Berrios' 100th major league win, which they didn't end up doing. But yeah, that's a big spot to toss a rookie into.
That's not the entry point you want for a 23-year-old pitching in the big leagues for the first time. But that's what the Blue Jays were forced into because, look, they're on a four-game winning streak right now. That's great. But the margin of victory in these four games have been 2-3, 2-2. And these are in games when the Blue Jays have had 7 hits, 10 hits, 12 hits, and 10 hits again. So they need to start thumping. Like, they need to start hitting for power. They need to start cashing some of these base runners. Like, yes, the Blue Jays swept the Washington Nationals. That's great. That's what they should have done. But instead of those wins being like 4-2 and 5-3 and 3-1, they need some of them to be 7-1 and 8-3 and 6-2.
Yeah, the Athaletters prescription for winning: hit dingers, keep the bullpen rolling, then this team will be piling up the victories, which is, I don't know, man. Like, for me, even just seeing them at 5-2, and I know it's just 1 week, but seeing the record at 5-2, I just think they needed this so badly. I think that a bad start, if they were 2-5 right now, I think the vibes within that clubhouse, like, you know, they could have withstood one bad week, but you don't want to send the clubhouse into a spiral early. And I think 5-2 is a really good way for the vibes around this team to improve for all involved.
This has been the Decision of the Week, brought to you by MLB The Show 25. Well, what's really important about what you just said, Ben, the Blue Jays opening at 5-2, why that's so crucial, is because they're about to go on a 10-game road trip where they go to Citi Field and then Fenway Park and then Camden Yards, which are not easy opponents, not easy places to play. Three city road trips, never easy as it is. And then, oh, by the way, then they come straight home without an off day to host the Atlanta Braves, who I know are not getting off to the best start of the season, but you color me skeptical that that's going to continue for a team with as much talent as they have. So, you know, going 5-2 on this homestand does give you some margin for error on this road trip. I think like a slam dunk on this road trip would be like 7-3. I can't imagine the Blue Jays doing any better than that. Yeah. And I think that if they come away 5-5, they should honestly be pretty happy with it.
Yes, agreed. If you go 5-5 on this road trip, then that is a success. Just given these teams are really good. The Red Sox are really good. The Mets, I mean, their rotation is kind of in shambles right now, but they still have so much offense. And, you know, it's not like they're... Even their depth starters are capable. If you're looking into McGill or a Peterson, those guys can still pitch. Baltimore, we just saw them. I mean, I think Baltimore is really good. I picked them to be in the World Series, actually, along with the Mets. So that tells you what I think about these two teams. So it's going to be really tough. I think adding to the challenge here is you look at these three cities, right? New York, Boston, Baltimore. And it's not exactly like San Diego as far as weather. And at this point in the season, none of these stadiums have roofs. Like, I think that we're going to see a rain delay or two, maybe a rain out at some point during that Red Sox series. I know I'm going to turn the game on and it's going to be like plays of the month because it's just in an indefinite delay. I think that's going to add wrinkles to what's happening here. And it's going to add to the challenge from a pitching staff standpoint, where you might get someone ready to go and then you have rain, or you have him through three innings and then it's a rain out, and that could really tax the bullpen. So you probably want to have some guys who are a phone call away at Buffalo and, you know, make sure that they're ready to join the team at a moment's notice, just given the weather unpredictability that could happen here.
Yeah, the 27th roster spot could come into play here. You know, for a Josh Walker or a Dylan Tate, perhaps even an Eric Lauer if you need somebody who can actually like start a game for you. So yep. I think that's a good point. Like, this is a trip that's going to test the Blue Jays on a few different levels. And it comes rather early in the season, and it comes after the bullpen carried a pretty big load over the first week of the season. So again, this is somewhere where the offense could really do the Blue Jays as a team some favors by breaking out and by hitting some homers and putting up some crooked numbers and just like alleviating the pressure a little bit and just making some of the decisions a bit easier for John Schneider and Pete Walker, for creating some more Jacob Barnes situations and Mason Fluardi's situations, rather than like another tough lefty coming up. Like, can Brendan Little go 3 out of 4 here? Like, will the command and the stuff be there, and will it be as crisp as it needs to be? Like, yeah, I mean, Jeff Hoffman like said he's good to go after throwing 20 pitches yesterday, but do we want to push him that hard this early in the season? Like, if you can avoid some of that decision making on this trip, that would be great. But yeah, like, baseball being baseball, and the, you know, nature of the environments the Blue Jays are going to, and the nature of the teams that they're playing against as well, like you said, you know, yeah, like the Mets rotation isn't great, and you know, the Orioles pitching is not their strength this year, but the Mets, the Red Sox, the Orioles, like, these are all teams that hit very well in their ballpark, hit very well in general, have a lot of power in their lineups. So it wouldn't be surprising if the Blue Jays are going to need to score like 6 or 7 runs in a few of these games to come away with a win.
Oh, seriously. Maybe like 10 or 11, or who knows where it'll go. I mean, Gunnar Henderson will be back with the Orioles by the time the Jays make it to Baltimore for a series that you and I will be covering next weekend. That Orioles offense was good already. I know Cowser's down now, but, you know, to add Gunnar Henderson to that group, they're stacked, man. That is a really, really good offensive team. So it's going to be a challenge. And one other sort of narrative thing I'll be watching for, I just mean I'll be watching for it. I'm not hoping that anything happens on this front, but Vlad Jr. going to New York and then going to Boston, right? These are two really big media markets. We know that the Mets have been linked to Vladdy, with Steve Cohen already being asked about him. And of course, if Vladdy hits free agency, we can expect that the Mets will show some degree of interest, maybe even a high degree of interest. So that's going to be a storyline. And you'll have national writers, you'll have potentially Yankees writers who are there. Does that become something? Hopefully it's, from my standpoint, I'm not hoping for anything. I'm just curious to see which direction it goes. And then Boston as well is another place where that is a big media market, and there's the potential for some headlines. And we've seen, like, look, candidly, Vlad Jr. hasn't necessarily managed this as super carefully so far. He's talked a lot. So, you know, barring a change, there could be more comments that he's made, or maybe he'll decide, you know what, I actually want to just dial that back a bit. So we'll see which direction it goes.
Well, and we've both been to New York with the Jays in years, and at times when Vladdy wasn't the center of like all gossip and rumor and speculation in the sport, and he still gets interviewed a lot.
Yeah.
Because like, just regardless of whether he's a big topic or not, like, he is still, there's a line of people in New York to talk to him. And like, to his credit, like, he makes time for all of them. You know, like, whether he's hitting well or he's not, like, he will do multiple Spanish language interviews whenever he's in New York. And like, he will find time for like the, you know, New York writers who come over to talk to him. Like, he's a very accessible guy when he's there. So I would imagine that that's going to happen again. And like you said, yeah, Boston, it's going to happen at some point when he's there, because like, the fit is just like so natural and so obvious. And even with like all the Devers stuff that's going on right now, like, you can just imagine all the various angles and stories that some of their writers can come up with when it comes to Vladdy and the future of the Red Red Sox and the big extension they just signed with Crochet and how they're going to try to pivot, you know, position themselves to be competitive for years to come. It's going to be a thing regardless. Yeah. But like I said, he's someone who always makes time for the other side's media when he's in New York. So don't think that, like, because Vlad gives some interviews when he's at Citi Field or when he's in the Bronx later this month, that that's him negotiating or leveraging or trying to send some sort of message. This is something that he does regardless of his contract status when he's in that city.
That's a really good point. And so, yeah, if you see Vlad Jr. commenting on his status, or if you see a headline coming out of New York, I would say it's quite likely that that's not Vlad Jr., you know, seeking out a New York writer and being like, hey, I want to, you know, let's back channel this. I think it's far more likely that those writers are approaching him, as, you know, that's part of their job. And then the headlines result from that. So something to sort of keep in mind. And then, yeah, to your point about Crochet and Christian Campbell and those extensions, not to, I know we got to run here shortly, not to dwell on the Red Sox, but man, are they ever well positioned. You look at that overall franchise and the direction that they're heading in now, to have Crochet locked up, to have Campbell locked up, that is a team to be reckoned with in this division for the next 5 years.
Yeah, my very quick take is that I like the Crochet deal for Crochet. I like the Campbell deal for the Red Sox. And I really like the Jackson Merrill deal for the Padres. Holy smokes. That I would not have advised him to sign that.
No, same here. On the Jackson Merrill deal, what a move by AJ Preller. Let's say that. I don't want to say anything bad about agents that I don't know, but let's just say that that is an amazing deal by AJ Preller.
Yes, absolutely. That's the sort of thing that you sign up for. Like, as a team, it's very unlikely that that doesn't go well. Like, that's such a good bet to make. And honestly, like, the Christian Campbell one looks pretty good for the Red Sox as well. Like, obviously, he's a little bit more of, like, an out-of-nowhere talent rather than, like, Jackson Merrill, who everyone was pretty sure he was going to be good and pretty sure he's going to continue to be good. Like, with Christian Campbell, like, he's kind of been a late bloomer and came on sort of suddenly, and so maybe there's some question as to, like, how sustainable it is, and is, you know, there's the Scott Kingery of it all. Like, there's always those cautionary tales, but I mean, if he continues being the guy who he is, it's a slam dunk. If he even, like, takes a little bit of a step back from the amazing minor league numbers that we saw, I still think that the Red Sox are getting tremendous value on that deal.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me turn to the Blue Jays roster and think, is there someone really young on this roster that they should be trying to, you know, get something done with early? Because you see how expensive it can get with Bo, with Vlad. You know, not saying that would have been easy, but it certainly gets more expensive the closer you get to free agency. And I don't know that anyone on this Blue Jays roster screams extension, except for potentially Dalton Varsho. There could be a nice middle ground to be found there. It's something you got to keep in mind, because there are sometimes opportunities to really set your organization up longer term.
Varsho is the only guy I would point to, but he recently joined the Boris Corporation, as we all know. So that's probably going to make it a bit more difficult to sign him to an extension. Boris clients typically very reticent to sign extensions, and that is an agent who typically pushes his clients pretty hard to test free agency.
Yep, might be looking to get that Brandon Nimmo money for Dalton Varsho in a couple of years, so we'll see.
All right, that's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. I want to thank our producer, Christian Ryan. I want to thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25.